wanted to welcome you all to the Not Confessed dinner. It is fantastic to see all of you here, though I was just looking for someone and they were all wearing the same thing and I couldn't find him. So one of the purposes of the Not Confessed is to hear stories. David is a great lover of stories. So we're going to be telling you stories throughout the evening. First person who will speak is Hank Levy. He is David's successor as chair of the department.
Thanks, Mike. Since I'm starting, I thought I would tell a story that I really like that involves both David and the department. And you all probably received this invitation. And if you remember, there's a strange picture in the lower right. And I thought I would explain that picture. Those of you who were there remember this as one of the most memorable events in department history. But many of you here weren't there. So actually, this was almost exactly 7 years ago, because it was the year I took over as chair. We switched kind of towards the end of the academic year, so I asked David, since he had been chair during most of it, to do the honors at the graduation ceremony, to hand out the diplomas and shake everybody's hands. So if you don't know, our graduation ceremony is in Meany Hall Theater, which is this very grand space, formal space, holds 1,300 people, and we fill it. And if you think about the kinds of graduation ceremonies you're used to and the pomp and circumstance and stuff like that, this wasn't it. So David was up there shaking hands and handing out diplomas. And I remember suddenly I saw a student of mine who had been in my professional master's course named Ian King coming up to the podium. And I kind of said to myself, maybe I should have told David about Ian. So Ian is in his 50s, big, burly, kind of rough-skinned motorcycle rider who always wears a leather kilt. It's his motorcycle kilt. So he's a little unusual as one of our graduating students. So I'm watching David. David's up there, and Ian comes up. And as Ian goes up, you know, I can see David's eyes catch him. And David is in full gown, you know, black gown, hood. And I see David suddenly go like this, and he sees Ian, and Ian sees David looking at him, and Ian walks over to him kind of shyly with his leather kilt, and suddenly David turns around in a 1,300-person theater, sorry, this is a visual joke, and goes like this. And what's under his gown, luckily, is a plaid kilt. This is the Carnegie Mellon kilt. And then the two of them dance around on the stage together. And it's a great moment because, again, in the context of a graduation ceremony, it shows David's sense of humor and also speaks to the department and the way we act and our sense of humor, which is very much David's. And I've told this story many times because it's actually one of my favorite moments of department history. And it was a great thing to see. So that's my story.
Thanks a lot, Hank. Next to speak will be Bill Griswold. He's one of David's earliest students.
Hello, everybody. So I know this would be a particularly good time to tell a funny joke, a funny story about David. But unfortunately, all of those stories that I have are somewhat embarrassing to me. So I'm instead going to tell a little bit more serious story, which is how I got my dissertation topic. So it was 1988 or so, and I had read this paper by Tony Hoare. Mike talked about it earlier in the earlier in his talk, and I started applying Tony Hoare's ideas to these small programs that I was writing, just fiddling around. And David and I had developed a kind of rapport, because if you worked with David, you know what I'm talking about. I just told him everything that I was doing, even stuff I wasn't supposed to be doing, perhaps. And then I went off to internship at IBM Research to work with Backus, actually, on functional programming. And one day, David gives me a call and says, Bill, I have an idea. It's program restructuring, and you can call me back in 2 weeks and tell me it was your idea. And so 2 weeks later, I called him back and I said, David, This was my idea. But what it shows you is that dynamic between an advisor and a student. I didn't know how to recognize a research idea from just any other idea, just fiddling around. But David saw what I was doing and understood the value in it and got me pointed in the right direction. And it's something I'm obviously forever grateful for because it's changed my whole entire life forever, and I'm just very grateful. So thank you.
So next will be Tao Shear, who is another of David's PhD students. He's currently on the faculty at North Carolina State.
Good evening. I have feel high pressure. I cannot tell a very funny joke or story, but I try my best. Although David is not a superhero, but I would say he's a super advisor, different from supervisor, right? Super advisor. Okay, use a term, from now on. Okay, so thanks for the pros. I would tell a kind of a story. Probably not many people would know. Back in one day in 2004, several students in David's group went into David's office for meeting with David in a group. So basically, before that kind of meeting, we have some kind of discussion. Some of them could be funny. Lindsay was in part of the son of the section. We were kind of talking about, because at that time, David was the department chair and a lot of professional services, along with some health issues at that time. Some students in the group couldn't feel getting enough guidance in terms of picking the research topic to get things going. We have some brainstorming sections. One funny question was asked at that time, within the students, why David was keeping forgetting what we talked about last week? Just ask again, what was the big picture of this? Or what was, now as a professor myself, I know it's very important to revisit again and again, right? But at that time, quite some of us did not realize, complaining, David was forgetting. Okay, basically went into the room, and then David basically said, I was actually expecting you to come over to talk. And he basically explained the reasons, and he basically described a constructive solution to deal with some of the students who would need help, co-advising, another professor, or getting a collaborator from outside the university. And originally, we prepared a lot of things to say, but we were just David said it all, right? we couldn't, we wasted kind of the materials that we prepared. And I think the things that, about 2 weeks later, David was invited to give a seminar talk at the graduate student for the whole university, being a representative of past UW, a distinguished mentor, a graduate mentor. So during the talk, I was there because I don't want to miss any opportunity to listen to what David said, because in one-on-one meeting, I just use up every minute allocated for me meeting with David. That's how some of the software engineering, genealogy, and other non-research stuff came up. But anyway, get back to that. David explicitly quoted such case in his talk, and then encouraged this new graduate student to really openly discuss with his advisor if they have some issue or concerns. That kind of struck me in some specific way, because these days, I have my own student, I meet with them, I may have some, kind of a tension with them in every now and then, but I think David's experience or my observation on David really taught me how to be a great advisor, and I still have a long way to go to learn more along the way. Thank you.
So next up is Judy Ramey. She served with David on the College of Engineering Executive Committee when they were chairs.
I think we had a remark earlier today pointing out that David was one of the most active supporters of women in engineering and women in computer science that we have had in the college. And so we were talking upstairs in Low Hall, Eve Riskin and Don Lehman and I, and we decided that given all that he's done for women in the College of Engineering, that we would make David an honorary woman. So I am proud to tell you that the University of Washington now has the first all-female leadership team in any College of Engineering in the United States. So thank you for that, David. But that actually isn't my story. Way back when I was chair of what was then Technical Communication, this was before David was chair of the College of Engineering, but he always took very great interest in programmatic matters, especially for undergraduates. So we had this writing program, service program for the college, and we had decided to make some changes in it. And they were going to be pretty far-reaching. I actually don't even remember what they were. But it was a very big deal, and we were really excited about it. And David and I found ourselves on opposite sides of the issue. And so I was looking around, and I found some materials, especially a particularly persuasive citation that supported my point of view. And so I sent it to him. And I just put FYI, sent it along. Instantly, I get this email back. It says, I know what FY means, but what does the I stand for? So, no matter how serious the issue is, David finds a way to make it funny. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. So the next speaker is Charlie Carroll, and he knew David a long time ago when David was a grad student at CMU.
So I can see that I'm older and than most of this young and intimidatingly good-looking crowd, so let's start with a little show of hands here. Who remembers when Friends was first aired? All right, pretty good. That was pretty easy. How about when the Pittsburgh Pirates were actually a good baseball team? Woo, I'm impressed. All right. How about Mr. Peabody?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, all right, a few. For those of you that don't remember Mr. Peabody, he's a little hard to explain. He's a genius dog with big glasses, bow tie, lots of bad puns, on a TV show with a squirrel, a moose, and Russian spies. But you can check him out on YouTube. What I need from Mr. Peabody is his Wayback Machine. So we're going to go in the Wayback Machine to 1977. When I was living my version of Friends. I just graduated from CMU. I'd taken a job in Pittsburgh. I fell in with the worst kind of people, a bunch of CMU CS graduate students, and we all rented a house near campus. One of the occupants of the house was Paul Hilfinger. He's now a professor at Berkeley. Paul was our resident nerd. I think he wanted to be British. He was always very proper. He kind of liked his Gilbert and Sullivan. There was Diane and her sidekick, Boomer. Every good sitcom needs a girl, but I think Boomer was the star of the show. Kaboom was a dog that could crawl on her belly like a commando and play the piano. There was yours truly, not to brag. I was the OCD guy, so I knew every license plate of everybody that worked at my company. That was sort of my role in this. That's not funny. What are you guys laughing at? And that brings us to David. So what was David's role in this real-life sitcom? I know this is going to be a big shock, but David was the wild and crazy guy. So you've all seen the results of his lifelong ambition to look like somebody famous. So Mike brought up Gandalf earlier. I was thinking Alexander Solzhenitsyn, but you kind of get the idea that he's always wanted to be famous. But all that sort of prep. The story I really want to tell happens in the fall of 1979. So the Pittsburgh Pirates are a good baseball team. They're playing the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. They split the first six games. David, in his wild and crazy way, decides that we should go see Game 7. A couple of problems. One, we don't have tickets, and you need tickets to get in to see the World Series. No problem, David says. I'm a big city boy. I can scalp tickets. We'll get tickets. Okay, we say. Number two, the seventh game is going to be played in Baltimore, and we're in Pittsburgh. No problem, David says. I can get us a car. So four of us woke up early on the morning of Wednesday, October 17th. We got in our car. We drove the several hours to Baltimore. He got us tickets, and we got in to see Game 7 of the World Series. And I will always remember the magical moment in the sixth inning. The Pirates trailing 1-0, a guy on first base. Willie Stargell hits this towering shot to right field to put the Pirates ahead. I stood up and cheered for all I was worth until David tugged me on the sleeve and pointed at the 50,000 very unhappy Baltimore Oriole fans. So I very quietly sat back down and practiced a more subdued kind of happiness as the Pirates held on to win that game and to win the World Series. And let me tell you, it was a great day in my life. So there's a lesson in all this. Some years later, I took a job in Minneapolis, and twice since then, the Minnesota Twins have been to the World Series, and twice that series has gone the full seven games, and twice that seventh and deciding game was played at the Metrodome, less than 10 miles from where I live, and I did not go to either Game 7. So what's the lesson? Grab your chances when you have them, and be grateful to the wild and crazy guys who make so many of the good times happen. Thank you, David.
Next up is Ann Condon. She's probably best known for being the wife of the premier webmaster in the Northwest. She's also done incredible research. She's chair of the CS department at UBC and so forth.
Thank you. Like Judy, I'd like to share a couple of anecdotes about David's support of women in computing, one very personal and one very public. Let me start with the personal one. It's very easy to open up to David because he's non-judgmental and genuinely affirming. I remember once being at lunch at a professional meeting, sitting with David and other people, and the conversation was around career trajectories. And somehow I got off on a tangent into a very self-deprecating tirade about all the mistakes I'd made in my career, and if I'd only done X or if I'd worked harder at Y, maybe it could have been better. And the person on one side of me was like nodding sympathetically at my grievous errors. And then David just burst out laughing and said, "But Anne, you've done great." And I just burst out laughing. And ever since then, when I'm tempted to doubt my own career choices, I think of David and I smile and I resist the temptation. So thank you, David. That was my personal story, and my public story is one that Mary Lou Soffa shared with me. Mary Lou is a very prestigious researcher in compilers and software engineering, and probably the most outspoken person I know. Once a senior officer from a very prominent computing organization proudly unveiled a video about opportunities in computer science. Now, in this video, all of the people profiled were white males, except for one little girl. Mary Lou, in true fashion, stood up, and she did not mince words as she told this senior official what she thought of that video. When she was done, there was total silence in the room. And then one voice spoke up, questioned the choice of profiles in that video, and spoke to the importance of diversity as part of the vision of this organization. And that person was David Notkin. Mary Lou is with us in spirit tonight, and she's tremendously appreciative of your gesture at that moment, David. And to finish, I would like to offer a word of caution to anyone who might think of following in David's footsteps. After that, Mary Lou nominated David for every committee she could think of. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to welcome Martha Pollack, who has a distinguished career as a professor and also as a senior administrator.
So although not planned, I think you'll see a theme here. The story I want to tell you took place about 9 years ago. I was a brand new chair of the computer science division at University of Michigan. I was at my very first Snowbird conference. For those of you who don't know, Snowbird is a biennial conference of computer science and information chairs and deans. I didn't know very many people there, and I was out at the opening reception. For those of you know that beautiful reception on the patio with the mountains around you, and I was standing around, and I didn't know very many people, and this person with this enormous beard came up to me and started talking with me, and it was, you know, we had a nice conversation. Oh, you're a new chair. You talked for a while, and then we went on to dinner, and that was that. And then the next day, or maybe it was the day after, but in one of the breaks between sessions, David came up to me again. He sought me out, and he said, Martha, remembered my name, he said, I've been thinking, and you know, you need to know that all department chairs face challenges that are tricky, and if you have any challenges that you want to talk to someone about, we all need that. Here's my email address. Just email me or call me. Now, that may seem like a small gesture, and in a way it is, but it was a really meaningful gesture. First of all, he really meant it. This one wasn't one of those, yeah, call me if you need something at the end of our conversation. He sought me out, and he gave me his email, and that was the first important thing. But secondly was the way he phrased it. He said to me, oh, everybody has these challenges, and I have to tell you that I had spent the previous day looking at all these department chairs strut their stuff, looking at their self-confidence and thinking, oh, my God, I'm never going to make it as an administrator. And David just diffused all that by saying, you know, without saying in so many words, we all share these things. I probably did call him once, maybe, but I became a member of the CRA board, and we interacted twice a year at CRA meetings, maybe one or two other times. Honestly, I've only had the pleasure of interacting face-to-face with David less than 24 times. But when I think about it, I think life is a combination of those big accomplishments that everybody knows about, and Mike so wonderfully talked about those of David's earlier today, and also those small gestures that go unrecognized by anyone except the people who are on the receiving end of them. And David is a master of the small gesture, and I'm just here representing all the people, hundreds and thousands of people, who maybe have only interacted with him 24 times or 12 times or once, but whose life is better because of the small gesture he made.
Next up is Gaetano Borriello. He's a friend of David's who's been on the faculty here for over 25 years.
So I've had many more than a few dozen interactions with David. And one, you know, we've been talking a lot about students today and about David's mentoring and of those students. And I got to say that, you know, I think people don't realize how much we learn from each other on the faculty of these departments. And certainly for me, David is one of those key people that I learned a lot from over those 25 years. And one of the things that, though, I still am not able to reproduce is really David's ability to really get to the real key part of the problem and come up with a very simple way of explaining it. So just to give you a case in point, you know, there's always been a debate going on in this country, in the world, you know, about what a university education is really about and what its value is. And the competing concerns of the ability to get a job when you graduate. And fortunately, we don't have that problem in our department. Our students do fantastically well. But, you know, we were having this discussion one day, and David gave me something that I can't tell you how many times I've used because it works like a charm, to explain to people what the difference is between education and training. And David's solution was just add one word. Ask people to whether they would want their child to be in sex education or sex training.
Next, we'll hear from Bobby Schnabel, and he knows David from the CRA board, from NC WIT. He's going to tell a story called David the Matchmaker.
I think I've got to start with excuse first, which is I think I got up at what amounts to 2 a.m. East or Pacific time on the East Coast. So if these remarks become totally incoherent, I'm claiming that that's the excuse. So yeah, the little title of this vignette is David the Matchmaker, but that now that that's got you thinking this is going to be something truly alluring, it's actually David the Academic Matchmaker. And it's really just meant to be another example of how David, in his way, has influenced people's careers and their lives through the way he's reached out to people. The subtitle of this should be why the HCDE department here at UW should thank David Notkin for the fact that they got to recruit and hire Kate Starbird last spring. And Kate's right out here, so I'm not talking about her behind her back. And what's more precisely, it's really how David set in motion the series of events that led to Kate being on the market to be hired at that point. So this all goes back to something that's been alluded to a number of times, which is David's involvement with women in engineering and computing, and in this case, the National Center for Women in IT. David and Carla Ellis, where's Carla? There's Carla, is here tonight as well, were the first co-chairs of what's called the Academic Alliance of NC Whitney, and they did a wonderful job getting that started. And David's role was really important. He came to it with enthusiasm, with commitment, and it really set the tone that men as well as women would be involved in NC Wit. Well, getting back to this story, for that reason, in I think it was the fall of 2006, the three executive team members of NC Wit, Lucy Sanders, who's back there as well, Telly Whitney and myself, decided to have a meeting here at UW with David and Carla. And David suggested by email that he wanted to bring somebody to lunch at that meeting who he'd met in the community and thought might be an interesting person to get involved with NC Wit, and that was Kate. Kate had just retired from a 9-year career playing pro basketball and had returned to her hometown of Seattle, where, among other things, she was doing a really neat program that was involving girls in a combination of sports and computing, and that was the way that that got into NC Wit. Now, I actually knew Kate's name. My wife and I are big women's basketball fans, and Kate had been the National Women's Basketball Player of the Year at Stanford back in the late 90s, and so we knew that. And it was less known that Kate had also been a successful computer science major and had actually co-founded a computer graphics company while she was playing pro ball. What I don't know to this day is how David knew Kate, but I have a theory. David's kind of tall. And so I think he's been just modestly hiding from us a basketball past of his own, and that he had actually been coaching Kate on the side. In any case, what happened at that lunch is that we got to talking and found out that Kate was actually looking to go back to graduate school but had a really well-thought-out idea of what she wanted to do. The trouble is that it didn't exist. And it was a very interdisciplinary idea. And it turned out it actually did exist at Colorado, where Lucy and I were. And at that point, this actually becomes much more a story about Kate than about David. So I'll just abridge it to say that Kate went on to have a stellar career as a graduate student and put herself in a position that she was a great person to be hired here at UW. I'm sure she's going to go on to have a great career here and in general. And it's just another person's life that took a turn that was due to David Notkin.